This is Matt Rogers from Los Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Los Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
You know when people try a new food and suddenly it's like, okay, hold on, I got a new favorite food.
That's the reaction a lot of people are having when they first try Kewpie Mayo.
Yeah, it's the one with the red cap and the little baby on the bottle. You've probably seen it at the grocery store.
And this mayo is different.
Mm-hmm. Most mayonnaise uses whole eggs. Kewpie only uses egg yolks, which gives it this rich umami flavor. It's smoother, deeper, almost buttery.
Once people try it, they start putting it on everything. Egg sandwiches, fries, burgers.
Chefs use it. Restaurants use it. People who really care about flavor use it.
Put it on just about anything.
Then you'll understand.
Kewpie, the original Japanese mayonnaise.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
2-1. We are live with Stanislav. Many of you have seen him on Danny Haifong's channel, Nima's channel, giving people nightmares about the prospects of nuclear war. Excellent coverage on, you know, Russia versus Ukraine, coverage on Iran, etc. First time on the channel, my friend. So, you know, just for the viewers then, just want to give a little bit about your background so they know how you became an expert in these subjects, please. And huge thank you for coming on.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, I was born in Voroshilovgrad, which is now Lugansk. And my father was a political dissident, took the family to the U.S. in 79. Actually, he wanted to go to Germany or England. My mother wanted to go to U.S., so we wanted to go to the U.S. Then, you know, I grew up in the U.S. From 79, went through high school, went to university. Joined the military as an enlisted in the Guard, which is the reserve, and then went active duty as an officer in 95. So fully served out 11 years. Did a lot of different positions, and one of them was in Dragon Brigade, which is the headquarters brigade for 18th Airborne Corps, where I was in G3, which is the operations branch. This is the planning and execution branch for Corps. Which is 18th Airborne Corps is four divisions. It's 82nd Airborne, 101st Air Assault, which used to be an airborne division, 10th Mountain, and 3rd Mechanized, which is the only heavy division they have, and then a bunch of other units. And then, which, by the way, one of the reasons I left them, well, probably the biggest reason I left the military, got to major's rank, turned it down, and then left. Was because all we were doing was, except for the short time we were preparing the plans to take Baghdad, everything else, all the scenarios, this is starting 1999, were for war with Russia. This was back when Bush is looking in the eyes of Putin and saying, yes, I looked in his eyes and we will be friends and all that. Meanwhile, we're preparing for war with Russia. And that just didn't sit with me very well. I was going to go fight my own people. So I decided to leave when the opportunity show up, which was a couple of years later, which is down the road. But a contract and the U.S. military has what is called the needs of the Army, which means we don't care what your contracts say. If your MOS, your military specialty is needed, you're sticking around to the retirement age for all we care. After that, quite shortly, I did some computer software development because it's my second degree that I finished while I was in the military, computer science. And then when that was going bust, watching the U.S. government import hundreds of thousands of technical visas where its own people are sitting around without jobs, myself included, going short contract to short contract, finished my MBA in supply chain management and went into the energy sector. So I worked in Cameron and Halliburton as a my last position, Halliburton. I was a senior supply chain director over Eurasia. And then, one of the most corrupt companies that you've ever seen, Halliburton. The stuff that the vice presidents and that company and the senior directors do is just mind-boggling, which is, by the way, why my senior vice president got fired, the junior vice president got walked out, and then the entire senior management team, myself included, got told bye-bye because we put everything back on its feet, but then we're standing in the way of everybody earning, you know, earning the old fashioned problem is you can only steal and cheat so much before everything starts to collapse, and you got to bring people in to put it all back up on its feet, and then you want to start earning again. But the problem when you put the people in to put it back up on its feet is they tend to be honest, and they get in the way of you making money the old fashioned way, just stealing it from the shareholders. So yeah, that's Halliburton in a nutshell. Anyways, going down the road, then worked for an Italian company as a director of supply chain on construction projects, on big oil and gas construction projects. That's why when I'm looking at the damage done, for example, in Qatar, you know, I know how long it takes to get the equipment in, design it, or designed, manufactured by hand, because it's all usually done by hand, get it in. So, you know, you can tell. I guess I was being conservative from the image I was seeing. I was saying something between 2.5 to 3 years. But what people are saying on the ground, the damage is so much more extensive than the visuals from the air that, you know, it's going to be 5-7 years before all that's back up and running. Just for those people to think the gas is going to come back sometime soon to Europe, it's not. That gas is gone. The fertilizer is gone. Russia is expanding on both, but Russia can't make up 30% of the world's fertilizer in a year. Or in probably in 5 years even, and definitely, and Russia's turned its back on the EU for gas and for oil on a permanent basis, possibly a very permanent basis. And then did a lot of consulting work for different companies in different areas. I was even in Ukraine in April of 21, till they figured out I was Russian. And then that contract ended really, really quickly. So that was it was a slip. I was describing how they could restructure contracts, like, oh, we can't do that. Well, you know, in Russia this is how it's done, and that set off somebody's alarm bell right off. But and then for the last 3 years, was it 3 years? Yeah, it's a lot, over 3 years since 23. I've been doing military political analyst, started on a lot of Russian channels, still on a lot of Russian channels, and migrated over with English language channels, some Arabic channels. I don't speak Arabic, they translate. Spread out like that, and an Iranian channel too. The Israelis won't invite me for obvious reasons. I'm on their naughty list, I'm pretty sure of that. And I also go down. I just came back from the Donbass quite literally last Monday night. Been down there about 14 times, I guess. I've lost track. I've been down a lot, including right up to the front lines, which is pretty hard to do. You can't really get up to the front lines anymore the way you used to. So we just drive up there. The most we were worried about. I'm former combat arms. We're probably more dangerous than the guys that are former combat officers. They worry more about us than some random civilians because we're crazy and we kind of understand what's going on and we go, okay, it's a risk. And they get really, really nervous about that because, frick, man, the artillery incoming doesn't really scare us that much. So it's like, okay, that's a little too brave. But yeah, drones have changed incredibly. Has changed everything, and you know the realization came. And it's going to be a little bit crude, so I'm sorry, but for people that are easily offended, it was in 23, and I was maybe 500 meters behind the front lines, and the guys that I was with that we delivered a lot of stuff to, they were spread out in different houses from this abandoned village, and I go outside. Because the outhouse was destroyed. So I go outside, evening, I'm propped up, my back against the wall, pants down, doing nature's deeds. And I'm thinking, man, if there's a drone that just drops a grenade on my head, this is a shit way to die. And that's the realization hits you. It's like, Jesus, you know, and these guys, they live with this on all sides. They live with this every single day. You know, I visit. They live with this, and you're sitting there because in the old days, you know, from where I was at, no sniper would have seen me, and nobody's going to drop artillery rounds on one guy taking a dump. It's not worth it, especially when you really can't even see what you're shooting at. But here with drones, I mean, literally, you literally, quite literally, cannot go take a dump somewhere without possibly somebody dropping something on your noggin. And that just changes reality for everybody to such an extent. The pressure is 24/7. I mean, we don't drive up anymore because you get killed. I mean, an automobile driving up is just such a prime target. I mean, I used to be, I'd get as close as the tank in front of me was the edge of the gray line, and past the tank was the gray line. That's it. You know, that's the line of contact. You can't do that anymore because just the drones are all over the place. If you're getting up to the front line, you're doing by foot, and you're doing by foot probably the last 4 or 5 kilometers. And then in small groups, that's the reality of it these days. It's a nasty business. And until the Chinese get their microwave EMP dishes up and running on a full scale manufacturing, they're field testing them right now. You're not going to have an area effect weapon that can take out drones in mass. So quite looking forward to field testing those in Russia, because they will be a game changer if they work as advertised. The premise and power of the drone is going to go down a lot, because you're no longer doing single kill fire like you do with lasers, shotguns, sniper rifles, netting, everything else. It's you're only able to service one target at a time. And if the lasers work great. It's a half second, and you've melted right through that drone, and drone goes down. Problem is you're only servicing one target at a time, and if you got 30, 40 drones flying at that one laser system on top of some pickup or armored vehicle, it gets destroyed. You need an area effect weapon, and then this is promising to be a big game changer that the Chinese have developed. And their radar system, if advertised as advertised, their radar system can pick up a cross section of 0.3 meters at 5 kilometers. You know, surrounding, a landscape dependent, of course, but that's a massive game changer. So things may change soon. That would allow maneuver warfare again to take off in a big scale.
Stanislav, you touched on so many important points right there. You know, going back to the Bush and Cheney crime family, evil Dick Cheney, the guy whose showers electrocuted more troops in Iraq, and then they brought another contractor in to fix the showers, also owned by Dick Cheney, the very showers he was killing their own troops with. And anyway, he's gone now. Good riddance. But you see, a lot of the times, young men, they enlist, Stanislav, their nuts are on the line, some IED blowing their nuts off, etc. So they come to a quick realization, why are we risking our lives? Did you have any such epiphanies that made you think about, the machinations of the American deep state?
Well, I mean, I guess I didn't have the delusions a lot of people had that, I knew what I was doing. I'm not going to lie. I knew. I mean, maybe I believed some of the BS for a little while. First of all, I'm a monarchist. Let's begin with that. So I'm already off the scale for American politics, and they had me slightly brainwashed for about 2 years after university, and then reality kicked in. Because the one good thing about Yugoslavia when I was serving there is I could understand the locals, not 100%, but about good 70-75%. Because Serbian is Serbo-Croatian is pretty close to Russian, and then a lot of them spoke also some amount of Russian, so we could communicate. And you start asking people reality of what's going on, which I had a lot of opportunities to do. And you look at the crap that you're being spoon-fed, and it has nothing to do with anything that's going on. And it's absolute made-up crap. So from that point of view, I don't think I've ever had a big delusion like a lot of people. Plus, my family background and such, so that gave a little bit of a different view on things. A lot of people, what you hear in the U.S., I'm not sure if you hear the same thing in Europe, probably not, but what you hear, the propaganda in the U.S. is we got to support the troops, they're protecting our freedoms. I'd just like to ask, what kind of a street whore freedoms do you have? because they keep getting, I guess they keep walking the streets and they get lost in Afghanistan. They get lost in Iraq. You know, your freedoms get lost in Yugoslavia. Their freedoms are lost now. And you got to go rescue your freedoms from their new John that's got them on the street. I mean, the stupidity of nobody stops to even think about this. Oh, we're fighting for our freedoms in Eastern Ukraine. Really? Because if that falls, your freedom of speech is going to go away. Your freedom to vote. Oh, no. That would be the Homeland Security that would take away that. Or, you know, the different censorships. Like you can't, you know, the new law in the U.S. where if you're taking a federal loan as a student, you can no longer criticize Israel. Now, you can criticize the U.S. all you want on a U.S. campus for taking federal loans from the U.S. government, but you can't criticize Israel. You know, there's something about the freedoms right there, but everybody's looking, oh, you know, it's in the Hormuz is our freedoms or some other idiotic. And they keep repeating this and people just buy into it. It's like you just stop for a second and think of the crap you're being spoon fed. But most people, they don't want to wake up. They don't want to go outside the comfort zone. And if you try to explain that to them or explain what's really going on, they'll get hostile. They'll get turned off or they'll actually just get hostile. It's the same. It's the same thing as you saw with, what the hell's his name? It just flew out of my head. The American guy that Snowden. There we go. Snowden. You know, Snowden's a traitor because he told you how your government is spying on you against its own laws and against the Constitution you're supposed to be living on. So he's a traitor. Yes, he's a traitor. It's that mentality. It's that sheep mentality. It's a herd. The sheep herder bows at them, they'll just repeat and keep going without stopping to actually think what you're being told. I mean, does anything you're being told make any logic? So from that point of view, I don't think I was ever that brainwashed to begin with. I knew what, you know, I quite well realized when I was risking my life, I gave my word, but did I believe in the mission? No, I carried it out. I knew it was bullshit, pardon my French, but I gave my word and I carried out my word to the best of my ability. But I wasn't under any delusions where, you know, fighting for freedom or democracy or some other, you know, slogan that the politicians put out. Can't say the same thing for a lot of other people, but I don't think the majority of the people, honestly speaking, I would say the majority of the people that have served out at least a few years, they sober up. It's not what you're signed up for, because most people go in. They're patriots when they go in, a lot of them. I won't say all of them. There's even some criminals that go in the U.S. military. I think they've returned that practice. The last guy like that I saw, I was enlisted and I was in airborne school, and we had a gangbanger from Los Angeles who shot five people, but he didn't kill any of them. Drive by, just open fire. So the judge gave him a choice, you know, 5 years in prison or 3 years in the military. So he went to learn how to shoot properly and jump out of airplanes. So, that was a practice. They may have returned that practice, I think. They may have. I'm not sure. I've heard rumors that they have. But that was a regular practice in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, at least the first half of the 90s. I didn't have anybody like that in any of my units that I got commanded or didn't know anybody. But that may have been the last person I saw like that was in airborne school. But, yeah, they were there. They weren't a majority. They were a small minority, but they were there. Like I said, I think the majority, they'll go in from a patriotic point of view. But I think they sober up relatively quickly if they've got any brain power at all, if they've got anything more than, you know, follow orders and have any kind of concept. They sober up pretty quickly when you go into a lot of these missions and you just, you know, it's crap. I mean, quite literally, it's crap. I've only known two good generals one of them, general, they're both one-star generals. General Hardin was a one-star general, knew him in Yugoslavia. And General Griffin, God rest his soul, he was actually a full-bird colonel when I served under him. And the man started his career as a Marine grunt. And this was in the 60s, so he was going off to various Latin American countries to establish democracy. as he said, you know, because the local American corporation had driven the locals into actual armed revolt, and the local puppet government couldn't do anything, so they called in the Marines to put down the revolt. And it's like, yeah, you know, it's. I remember he said something about, I think it was El Salvador, that there had been fighting, and said, yeah, there weren't too many people killed, especially from our side, and that was called a small war. But I guess for the guys that got killed, it wasn't so small. Like, that was just something he told us one time when we were sitting at lunch, and just stuck with me. So, yeah, so, I mean, you see the reality of it. You see the reality of just the crap that you're being sent to.
Yeah, and if people want to follow up on that, I'd recommend the Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Oh, he describes the propaganda mechanism, and they go in and they just pillage these countries, and they say they do these humanitarian things. It's disgusting. So before we get to, you know, talking about the present and the nuclear war stuff, I just want to briefly go back in time then. You know, go back to World War II, perhaps, to understand how Russia has been demonized, the need for an enemy, all this expenditure on military-industrial complex. So World War II, you know, Russia made huge sacrifices fighting the Nazis. But then immediately you had people like the Dulles brothers and Churchill warning about, you know, the Red Menace. Was that where it began, or does it predate that?
Well, no. If you're talking about organized Russophobia, that began probably about 500-600 years ago. You see, during the reign of Queen Elizabeth, otherwise known as the reign of Ion Grozny, Ion Vasilievich IV, I'm going to go back in history, sorry. The roots are roots. Ion Grozny means feared, not terrible. So the British discovered us because we didn't know we were lost. Our neighbors sure as hell knew we were around. The British discovered us up in Arkhangelsk. Now, Arkhangelsk is all the way up north, past the Scandinavian lands, up on the Arctic Sea. So when the British arrived, the first question most people ask, what the hell were the British doing up there? And the better question is, how much were the Sultans paying for white boys and white blonde, blue-eyed girls and boys and women, young women? That's right. The British were raiding the Norwegians who weren't Viking anymore. This is 1500s. They'd settled down. And the British got up to Arkhangelsk, and they ran into a fortress with cannons, a lot more cannons than they could handle. So at that point, they decided, you know, let's trade. And they opened up a trade route through Arkhangelsk to Moscow to Ion Grozny, the first czar of Russia. Before that, they were crown princes. Now it became a czar. Later on, they became emperors. And that was, the British had exclusive trade rights. As a matter of fact, the British embassy, this is an interesting point, the British embassy in Moscow was the former mansion of the Romanovs. And the Romanovs at this point were just a noble family. One of their women was a second wife of Ion Grozny, Ivan the Feared, which is how they maneuvered themselves in after the time of troubles in the civil wars into the position that they got. There's a lot more to it than that, but that's down and dirty. And by the way, it's a great little museum. You can go. It's not that far from the Kremlin. It's by a nice park, a big church right beside it, and the museum of the British trade house / embassy, former house of the Romanovs, which, by the way, is another dispelling of the British and Western propaganda against Russia, because that house is made out of stone blocks, and houses like that are scattered all over central Moscow that are still standing there from the 1500s and the 1400s, because the whole thing was trope was Moscow is just a dirty wooden city. It just burns all the time, and blah and blah and blah. And you look at it, and there's all these stone buildings from the 14th and the 1500s still standing there. Later on, but the 1600s they were brick, but these were cut stone buildings, and they're. They feel quite fine inside as part of modern Moscow. You get a really rich architectural mix and a lot of streets. But yeah, so, I mean, a very large part of Moscow was made out of stone. It wasn't wooden by the 1500s. But you get that kind of propaganda constantly. And to this degree, I'll tell you, you know, Russians are portrayed as these aggressive, barbaric animals in the East that just want to eat all of Europe, which, by the way, if you look at modern Russia plus the percentage, the part of the four provinces that have now become part of Russia, Russia is 42% of the European subcontinent of Eurasia. 42%. We don't need the rest of Europe. There's nothing in the rest of Europe we want. We just want our historical lands back, which is up and down the Dnieper, which the communists that Lenin broke apart and created this Frankenstein Ukraine out of whole cloth. Well, actually, chunks of whole cloth. But the there's nothing in Europe we want or need. And so this, I mean, I've got Irish friends who are doing, you know, they in Ireland, they're being told that the Russians are just going to swim across and conquer Ireland. Why? What has Europe got? It's a deindustrialized second world economy at best. Parts of it are flat out third world or falling in third world, flooded with people from God only knows where that have nothing in common, trash everywhere. The trains don't run on time in Germany anymore. Hell, sometimes they don't, from what my German friends are telling me. So I used to, I was stationed in Germany and they were great trains. Well, they're telling me now, sometimes they don't run, period, let alone on time. You know, there's nothing there that we want anymore. We wanted any technology we can either buy or develop ourselves. Russia quite literally graduates every year more engineers than any other country in the world. Look it up. Don't believe me. Look it up. More than even the China, and not per capita, but actual physical numbers of engineers. So no, there's absolutely nothing there that we want. We wanted peace, and we wanted trade, and that obviously didn't work out. And the reason I'm saying this, in this fantasy of Russian aggression, do you know who came up with the League of Nations as an idea that was being formed?
Was it Russia?
Nicholas II. In the 1880s and 90s, Nicholas II came up with the League of Nations. Russia was pushing for a comprehensive security structure for Europe for the last 140 friggin' years. We could have avoided World War I, World War II, and the death of non-Russian Europe, which we're seeing right now through the EU and everything else, if we'd ever gone on it. In 1948, Stalin asked to join NATO that was being formed, the night that officially came into being in 1949. He didn't quite get the point that, by the way, it's formed against you. Khrushchev, there's some saying that Khrushchev might have, I don't believe he did, but Stalin definitely did in 48. Yeltsin did in 92. Putin asked to join NATO in 2000, and we are where we are now. So to say that Russia is some aggressive, psychopathic regime, well, I mean, if you look at actual history instead of the talking points from Brussels and other places, you know it's not like that. And I will tell you, I figured out in 2001 that there's going to be a war with Russia between the EU and Russia. It's unavoidable.
And it's even worse than that, Stanislav, because all of the aggression has come from this side of the world, going back to the Crusades that were up north against Russia, going to Napoleon, going to Hitler, and now even Keir Starmer here telling the lads of the UK, you know, Russia's the threat after Ukraine. They're going to go, is Hitler all over again? You all need to get ready to go and die fighting the Russians. That's how we're being groomed here by our politicians, and it's absolutely sickening. So why does the West have this obsession with conquering Russia when it's failed so many times for their predecessors going back centuries? It's caused them to empires to implode. Look at Napoleon's Grand Armée.
I will tell you, and I'll tell you why I also figured out that the war was inevitable back in 2001, 24 years ago. Nobody on this side, by the way, wanted to hear me either when I told them that. Back when I came back in 2010, nobody here wanted to hear that this was coming and that I was helping plan it. They wanted to be in La La Land just the same, unfortunately. First of all, Kyiv was the third of six capitals in Russia. The first capital was Old Ladoga, which is up north on the Ladoga on Lake Ladoga, which was a part of the Hellenistic League of cities, city-states that was in the trade union. The problem is the northern Slavic, they're called tribes, but they all had cities and towns. We were called the town builders by the Western Germanics and others. And we called them Niemits. In Slavic, Niemits means from the root Niemoi, which means people that can't speak. Because they didn't have a written language, we were getting on with ours, and that's the word for Germans and for Westerners, Niemoi, Niemitz, people without a language. We couldn't understand them, I guess. But anyways, just a little historical thing. But so Rurik, whose wife was a Slav, she was a Sorb, who used to rule. Sorbs were the population of Eastern Germany at that point. There was no Eastern German lands. It was all Slavic. He was hired CEO in today's terms, because the common practice in the Rus lands was to hire princes. There was no hereditary rule. They were hired under a contract. And he was brought in under a contract because he was a neutral party to rule all these other Russian and some Ugric tribes in the area, because they didn't trust each other. They're fighting each other all the time. Slights and trade negotiations that would, eventually turn violent. So he was a neutral power. So that was the first capital. Then he built Novgorod, which was the second capital, and he died. And a couple of his men took Kiev. And Kiev was the westernmost vassal of the Jewish Khazar Empire. Now, the people in the Khazar Empire were all different religions, but the elites were all converted to Judaism. That was the only outside of Israel / Judea state that ever converted to Judaism as a state religion. And they were the westernmost vassal. So they were a small town that answered to the Khazar Empire. Just as a quick history, so when Rurik died, his sword brother, maybe he was his blood brother, nobody really knows, Oleg, he fostered his son Igor, and they came down there and they captured Kiev. Kiev was just a better place strategy. So they had the entire trade link from the Hellenistic League down to the Byzantine Empire, all through two rivers and cross land that would move the ships and the goods.
This is Matt Rogers from Los Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Los Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
You know when people try on new food and suddenly it's like, wait.
That's the reaction a lot of people are having when they first try Kewpie mayo.
It's the one with the red cap and the little baby on the bottle. You've probably seen it in the grocery store before.
And if you've ever just walked past it, some people would say that's a huge mistake.
Because this mayo is different.
Most mayonnaise uses whole eggs. Kewpie only uses egg yolks, which gives it this rich umami flavor. It's smoother, deeper, and almost buttery.
Once people try it, they start putting it on everything.
Egg sandwiches, fries, burgers. Some fans even swear by dipping pizza crust in it.
And once you notice it, you start seeing it everywhere.
Chefs use it. Restaurants use it. People who really care about flavor use it.
Never tried it? Grab the bottle with the red cap next time you're at the store.
Put it on just about anything.
Then you'll understand.
Kewpie, the original Japanese mayonnaise.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
So having said that, Kiev became the actual third capital. And then within 200 years, Kiev was no longer the capital because Andrei Bogolyubsky, he took everybody. There was like four lines of families coming from Rurik, and they're all fighting for power constantly. Constant little civil wars going on. And he took Kiev, and he refused to sit at the table of his ancestors, Stol Svoich Predkov, which then became known as Prestol, which became the throne, the word for throne. So he refused to sit there, and he sent his younger brother to sit there, and he made the capital of Vladimir, which is about 250 kilometers east of Moscow. That was the third capital. Then it was Tver, and then Moscow, and then St. Petersburg, and then Moscow again. That's how things moved. So having said that, because the Ukrainians are like, oh, yeah, it's all from Ukraine. Ukrainians are an artificial entity created by the communists. Actually, the first Ukrainians were created by the Austro-Hungarians in Carpathia the Carpathian Rus, Carpathian Russians that wanted to split off and join the Russian Empire back in the 1880s. But I'm running ahead. So why I'm saying all this? The first pan-European invasion, I'm talking non-Russian pan-European invasion, of Rus was by Boleslav Hrabry, the crown prince of Krakow, and his Holy Roman Empire allies, basically Germanics and others in those areas. And they came in 1012 AD. So for the last 1,014 years, we are being invaded on a constant basis from the West. They took Kiev. They forced St. Vladimir, the Red Sun, who Christianized Russia. And they forced him out. And by the way, this is how close things were, by the way. They were different religions because there was a Catholics and we were Orthodox. But Boleslav Hrabry was his father-in-law. That's as insane as the dynastic struggles get. But that was the first pan-European invasion. And then it got forced back out. And it's been ongoing since then. And, you know, when I talked worked in U.S. companies, we're talking to Americans, I tell them, our curses were white. Okay, why am I saying that? Because when Westerners arrive in Africa or Latin America or some parts of Asia, what do they see? They see yellow people, brown people, reddish-brown people. They see black people. They see people that don't look like them at all, right? So the mentality has always been, well, maybe we need to figure out how they think because, you know, they don't look like us, so they probably don't think like us. The problem for us has always been when they arrive in Russia, they see white, blue-eyed, blonde, redhead people that look like them. So you must think like us. Well, we don't. Oh, you're Christian like us. Well, yes, we're Christian, but we're not like you. We're Orthodox. We have a different there was a big theological split back before the schism even, between the Catholics and the Orthodox. And that's partially linguistical based because Greek is a more mythical-based language and Latin is a more legalistic-based language. And that changes the way you think of things, what language you use. And so what would happen is they can't understand why we don't think the way they do. They can't understand why our culture is different from them. So sooner or later, they all start trying to teach us how we should properly live. Well, we don't like that. We know how we want to live. And we kind of buck that back. And fine, you little bastards in the East, if you won't listen to us normally, we'll come with a sword and we'll teach you how to live. Well, the problem with us is we Slavs, we Eastern Slavs, with an admixture of some Norse also, we're really good at fighting. We don't like fighting, but we're really, really good at it. And the Russian state would have been probably a third the size it is now if just nobody invaded us. So that's the problem. They keep invading us. We keep burying them, and then we follow them home. Okay, fine. We'll just take for reparations this, and this. And that's how things went. So people don't want to face it. Just leave us the frick alone. You want to trade, we'll trade. You want to come with the sword, you will die by the sword. That's what Rus has always been built on. You know, you want to come break bread, we will happily break bread with you. Come with a sword, we will massacre you and follow you home. And not to be a party guest. And Europe just, there's very few people in Europe who weren't lazy enough to try to invade us at least once. If not by themselves, at least in a coalition. Okay, the Irish, the Portuguese, the Swiss, yeah, that's about it. Oh, we never fought a war with the Danes, but there were Danish Nazis who helped invade as part of Hitler's coalition. Yeah, that's about it. I may be missing one or two people. Well, the Serbs are our brothers. We never fought against them, obviously. But even the Greeks helped invade us once or time, Ray on us, but I won't count the Greeks. That's probably about it. Everybody else has come with a sword sooner or later into our lands.
So Stanislav, it's always backfired on them, though. Look, like I said earlier, what happened to Napoleon, what happened to Hitler, etc. Now we're in this era of mutually assured destruction, yet our leaders want to repeat the exact same mistakes by demonizing and attacking Russia, that their predecessors have made. But the cost of this now is all-out nuclear war. This is a completely different technology than we've ever had. So what are they going to do? Just scurry off to their bunkers and leave the rest of us to die? How delusional are these people? Or do they think that this first strike capability thing, we can take Russia out before they can even respond and live happily ever after? Are these people delusional or what?
Well, if it's a conventional war, I mean, they're going to lose anyways, because believe me, Russia's not on a war footing right now. With the amount Russia's manufacturing, just to understand, Russia's manufacturing 1,200 tanks a year right now, brand new tanks. Britain is manufacturing zero and has manufactured zero for the last 10 years. And the last 140 or so tanks, about a third of them are being cannibalized for parts. I actually had somebody argue with me that that's normal. No, normal is manufacturing components to replace. That's normal, not cannibalizing equipment. That's it's already issued. That's not normal. In 2001, I figured out that this war's inevitable. And I'll tell you why. In 2001, summer of 2001, I was on a exchange mission to Germany, to the German infantry school in Bavaria, for about a month. And there was a major, myself, I was a captain, there was a lieutenant, and a bunch of sergeants. And by the way, they have a much more intense training, and they're pretty damn good, or at least they had, let me rephrase that, infantry school in Bavaria than the U.S. Infantry school in Benning. I speak German. I mean, it's pretty bad German these days, but it was relatively good German back then. Plus, you know, after three beers, it was really good German as far as I was concerned. grammar went out the window and words flowed. But under every barracks was a Kneipe, a pub. And I would say there was a company that was a German company that was infantry company. That was sponsoring us, and I would just sit down there and drink beer with them and talk with them. You know, it's about 1 in the morning, and then by 6:30 we're in formation. Sometimes still a little wheezy, but you know, hey, the Germans are in no better condition. And then we go off to train with live ammunition and grenades, so yeah, that was a little on the risky side. But anyways, and I knew sooner or later, you know, the Germans would figure out that I may be a U.S. officer, but I'm not an American. They'd figure out I was Russian. And I was just wondering, you know, what the reaction would be. So this German staff sergeant, who's like a major German nationalist, this was 2001, keep in mind, he finds out that I'm Russian. And you know what his reaction was? Brother, yeah, not the reaction you think. Oh, they loved Russia. German national. This is 2001. This is just after the Chechen Wars 2.0. Russia, you know, Putin is just starting to try to put Russia back together after Yeltsin all but destroyed the entire country with his American handlers and British handlers and everybody else who wanted a piece and earned a piece. And, I mean, Russia is in a crap position, if you think about it. And they are looking at Russia as the example of a sovereign nation. Because this is 2001, and they despise the EU. The German nationalists despise the EU. And every other nationalist I've talked to in Italy and other countries, they all despise the EU. They despise Brussels. I think if most of them were given a choice, they would quite literally personally drive a nuclear weapon into Brussels just to get rid of it. on that level, just visceral hatred. And I just started thinking about it. It's like, you know, and Russia's going up, and there's only one trajectory. Russia will always get back on her feet. But you look at the EU and you look at Russia. The EU cannot absorb Russia, because the EU will become Russia. 150 million people, the biggest, now it's the biggest economy of Europe by purchasing power parity. It's the fourth largest economy in the world. It's got the fourth largest manufacturing base. Nobody talks about it, but it's there. And I've watched it for the last 15 years massively get re-renovated and expanded in heavy industry, because I dealt with heavy industry for oil and gas and supply chain. And I figured out back then, you know, they can't absorb Russia. Russia will never give up its sovereignty. Because anybody that tries to give up Russian sovereignty, Yeltsin was the closest thing that came to it, and Yeltsin was a one-off. And that, you know, all the people that think if we get rid of Vladimirovich Putin, we're going to get another liberal. No, you're going to find out Vladimir Vladimirovich is a conservative liberal and pro-European. What you're going to get after that is going to be called a nationalist. And baby, you're going to wish Putin was still in power. Trust you me on that one. There will never be another Yeltsin, at least not for the next 100 years or more. Not while that living memory is quite intact. So what's left? The EU cannot survive with Russia as its neighbor. Russia is a sovereign mega power. It cannot tolerate the EU. Not that Russia couldn't live with the EU can't live with Russia. Because the internal problem of the EU is the vast majority of the European people don't really want to be part of the EU. At the end of the day, they don't want to, they may want to have a union of trade the way it was supposed to be, but they don't want to give up their rights, their culture, and everything else to a bunch of psychopathic, inbred, mental midgets that are not elected and tell them how to live their lives and when to pick their fruits and when to scratch their arse and everything else. They don't want to do that. But so what's your choice? You know, America's far away. So you may not like the way the U.S. runs things, but they're on the other side of the ocean. Russia's on the other side of the border. So you either try to destroy Russia one way or the other, hopefully by internally trying to collapse Russia, which was the initial plan. That obviously didn't work. Or I guess you go to world war with it. That's the only way you keep power in the European Union.
But how would you go to world war when it's mutually assured destruction with nuclear weapons?
They're counting on conventional war, but Russia doesn't have to go to nuclear war. The reason that I'm saying Russia may go to nuclear war is the European plan right now is to overpower the Russian anti-aircraft systems, which right now are handling everything that's being thrown at. Some will always get through. Russia is a giant place, so they do find corridors that they can come through between radar systems. Those corridors would get plugged. A lot of it's because they're using EU/NATO airspace. Or, by the way, they're just being launched out of Estonia and Latvia, which I think Estonia may cease to exist very soon. Which, by the way, Estonia is almost half the populations are Russians that don't have citizenship, aren't even second-class citizens. And these aren't Soviet immigrants or something like that, as they try to write off. It's Narva, which the Fortress of Narva was established in 1284 by King Vladislav of Norway. Not Vladislav, Vladimir of Norway, but the Russian city of Rozgov, if I remember correctly, that's the name, was there before, about 300 years before. So Russians have been living there for over 1,000 years. That's core Russian lands. And they're treated like absolute crap. And right across the border, the artificial border that the Soviet Union drew, right across the border is Ivanograd, which was used to be really just one city, Narva and Ivanograd, and there's the rest of your countrymen sitting there. Imagine if tomorrow, you know, the Welsh were independent and they had a British city there and they were just treating the English there as absolute, just one step above animals with no rights. And, you know, people in England would probably be very upset with that, and rightly so. But that's kind of the situation. And then you're allowing drones to fly out of your airspace or lift out of your off your ground. And that sets a very bad precedent. Well, the problem is there the aim of these mental midgets is to overpower the Russian system. Step one. And step two, as we've seen them already try, is to take out, because you know who's behind this is still the US and the UK, first and foremost. Take out the Russian radar systems, early warning radar systems, and try to take out Russian strategic bombers and possibly submarines in port, which is part of the nuclear defensive triad. Now, Russia and China and every other nation except for America has a second strike doctrine. The U.S. has a first strike doctrine. Well, here's the little problem with the logic. You can survive one side having a first strike doctrine as long as you have the early warning systems up. So if they launch, we launch, they're not going to get a chance to take it without us exterminating them back. Now imagine a nuclear superpower. I'm not going to go and not an economic lightweight either, but a nuclear superpower in this case that's blind, while the other guy has a first strike doctrine. And what's your paranoia going to tell you? He's going to strike, and we can't see it coming. So the nuclear logic is strike first, use them while you can use them, because the other guy is going to take you out. So strike first and destroy everything that the other guy has, which means Europe, the non-Russian Europe burns first, then America burns, of course, Russia will burn, and we have just nuclear holocaust in the Northern Hemisphere. So, and that's an inescapable logic, if you think about it, because the Russian point of view is we're not going to go down. If we go down, we will take every single one of you with us. There's not going to be a Northern Hemisphere left. Everything north of the Rio Grande in North America and everything north of the Mediterranean is gone. That's the point. Nuclear superpowers do not lose wars. They exterminate everybody else. That's the reality of the situation. And Brussels is too stupid to realize that, I think.
So that sounds absolutely terrifying. But let me just go over some parts of it a bit slower then, because my head's going to explode thinking about this. So you're saying...
It should be terrifying. I mean, look... The 1980s short and medium range ballistic missiles came in, and the rest of Europe suddenly woke up to the fact this is not going to be a Soviet Union and America shooting each other. It's the first thing that's going to happen is Europe is going to be gone as a subcontinent of Eurasia. Europe will be gone, and then strikes will hit America and the Soviet Union from those sides. Everybody became paranoid. Huge peace movement, de-escalation, and probably for the first time in human history, realistically speaking, whole categories of massive weapons of mass destruction were banned. Medium and short-range ballistic nuclear missiles were off the table on all sides. And then the Yanks walked away from it. And we're back to square one. But this time, the Europeans don't seem to give a damn. They're oblivious to that. They will be the first ones to be evaporated.
So is this the same twisted logic then as when Trump said about the unprovoked attack on Iran? Israel was going to bomb Iran, so Iran was going to attack us, so we attack them first. So they just spin a line and first strike someone out of the blue who's not attacked them?
Yeah. And by the way, look, the Zionist coalition, that's what I'm going to call them because there's no better name for it right now, in this war, and the EU for the most part too, have shown that they're quite happy to do decapitation strikes. You know, there's a reason historically you don't try to kill the other guy's leadership. It's not because of some humanitarian feelings. It's because the other guy starts going after your leadership. That is you. And that seems to have been an oblivious point for America and the EU too. Look, you know, yeah, we may not be able to hit your president. We may not be, or chancellor or prime minister, or maybe the ministers, but you've got an awful lot of members of parliament. You've got lots of state members of parliament, local parliaments. You have sheriffs, you have judges. That's all part of the government. Then I guess that's all legal targets. That's the reality of that Pandora's box that the Americans, the British, the Israelis, most of all, have opened back up. There's a reason no country wanted to go down that road, because you've got lots of officials like any other country, and they're all targets now. Every single American official from a county sheriff on up to a federal judge or a state senator or federal senator, same thing with the British, and everybody else has a very big bullseye painted on him, his family, and anybody around him. That's the reality. That's why nations don't do that. And the West seems to have gone, you know, the West is ruled by adult children, by man children, or women children in this case. They have physical bodies of adults or even the elderly, but the mental concept of about a five-year-old. I want, I'm going to take. You know, and that's not even a five-year-old, it's like a three-year-old. In a sandbox. I want. That's all they know. I want. They don't have any maturity higher than that.
So what is the sequence of events then that would lead these people to launch a first strike?
Oh, they've already tried. 91 drones on Valdai. What do you call that but an assassination attempt? Just Russian anti-aircraft system electronic warfare took them all down. And when they took them down, there's a reason why... the head of special operations gave the U.S. ambassador the chipset from one of these drones. I mean, it's not that the only one. They had plenty of them. The Russian engineers took them. They decrypted them, and they all these drones had American given coordinates for Putin's residency. And here you go. That was an assassination attempt. Trump has said, what? Trump was on the phone with Putin, said, hey, I'm about to go talk with... This is like a gangland hit. You know, Trump likes to play, I'm Mr. Gangland. Trump's a beta male who's trying to make up for his lack of a spine for the most part. If we're going to talk real, I know several people that know him personally. One that used to be in his entourage. He is an absolute beta male. Face-to-face, he's a pussy. I'll just put it that way. He'll back the hell off. But as soon as you turn your back on him, you know, out comes the knives. Pardon my French if I'm offensive. But yeah, that's how he is. And, you know, what did he tell Putin? He was having a talk with Putin. I'm about to go into a conversation with Zelensky. Stick around and we'll talk afterwards. And at that time, 91 drones get launched at Putin's Valdai residency. Whether Putin was there or not, whether his number was being ghosted, apparently parts of his family were there, his grandchildren, some of his grandchildren anyway. So, yeah, that was taken, I think it was a very good wake-up moment. Since then, the U.S. and between Putin and Trump, there's only been two conversations this year. And there was a talking down to Trump on the first one. There was a welcome to sobriety, welcome to Jesus moment. Yeah, that's, you know, what do you call that if that's not a first strike, that assassination attempt?
So, Stanislav, we've only got about 5 minutes left, and I'd just like to get your view on Iran, how it's going to play out. You know, we're seeing the stock market hit new highs, Trump talking it up. But a lot of the commentators we've had on, Scott Ritter, et cetera, said we're heading for the Great Depression because of the oil price spike.
It's not just the oil price spike. Scott's right. Look, first, to understand the stock markets, a lot of people will tell you the stock markets are 80% fundamentals, 20% emotion. I'll probably say it's 90% emotion, 10% fundamentals. And the fundamentals get flushed at every opportunity. Look, let's look at reality. This isn't ending anytime soon. 20 million barrels are bowed off the market. Iran is not blocked. Iran is still getting ships out because the U.S. has only about half dozen ships to try to interdict anything. And they're stretched thin. And they're only there until the missiles really start firing. Then they either run or they get sunk. That's the reality of that. Those destroyers, Aegis destroyers are... on top of that, Iran is still getting oil out. It's got three directions to get oil out. It's got the Caspian. You can move the oil to Russia and then go down Russian pipelines. There's trucks now lined up. The same thing, by the way, Turkey was doing in Syria, as U.S. and Turkey were stealing Syrian oil. But now you've got trucks lined up on the Pakistani borders with literally barrels of oil, selling it that way. And you've got train line to China through Pakistan that's carrying oil. Yeah, it's clunkier, it's more expensive, but you get the oil out. So it's still going. Now, the Saudis have a way out right now through the Red Sea, but everybody else is screwed. The gas is gone. The gas is gone. The LNG is gone for at least the next 5 years. And with it, all that extra fertilizer. Russia is 40% of the world's chemical fertilizer. They're planning on expanding capacity by about another 10% this year. But they can't make up, so basically another 4%, in other words. They can't make up the other 30%. They can make about maybe 4% by the end of the year. This harvest, the harvests are screwed. Europe, by the way, Russia uses very little fertilizer because of black soil. It exports almost all its fertilizer. Russia has the least fertilizer by square hectare of land anywhere in the world because of black soil. The saying is, you know, you take a shovel handle and you put it in the ground, it'll sprout you a tree. That's what black soil is. That's, by the way, why also maneuvers end in those areas when the rainy season or the melt comes, because it's a quagmire like you can't even believe. It's not brown clay mud. It is a black earth quagmire. Everything sinks into it, and then it dries out. And you got to dig it back out, or freezes. So there's that. But it, physically, the fertilizer is gone. Europe's going to have a horrible harvest. The early harvest is coming in June. That's going to be a shock to the market. Prices are going to go sky high. You know, a friend of mine is a political professor in Italy. And he's told me several months ago, before all this started, in central and southern Italy, the poor families, they are barely feeding themselves at the end of the month. They don't have money. They're having very big problems feeding themselves at the end of the month. The budget runs out well before the month runs out. Now what do you do when the food prices double? Middle class and lower get screwed. And the lower classes may go into actual starvation. I mean, I'm not going to say whole nations are going to starve, maybe Albania, places like that, but you'll have classes of people, you know, lower classes, they'll literally be starving to death. And that's not just across the world. You know, the U.S. right now, U.S. was buying $600 million worth of Russian fertilizer last year. Unlike the EU, which are the biggest morons that humanity could breed, I've got massive disdain. And by the way, the British government's no better.
Look at Starmer,
like,
man.
The Habsburg. Yeah. I mean, too much inbreeding like the Habsburgs in Spain. With a slag jaw and drool. They haven't quite hit the slag. I mean, they have it, the slag jaw. But the U.S., for all it needs that. U.S. is much more practical than the EU could ever be. We'll sanction everything until we need something. And the sanctions are off in the next couple of years. So the U.S. had no problem buying Russian fertilizer, still does. But that $6 billion, $600 million turned into well over a billion. Costs have doubled. Quite literally, costs have doubled. And right now, the U.S. is losing about 50, 55 farming families a day. It's screwed. Gas, fertilizer. And then you're getting things like you're not going to have enough rubbers. So I guess more babies will get born because the latex is in short supply. It's not just gloves. Latex gets used for plenty of things. So I guess rubbers are going to be, condoms are going to triple in price, maybe more than that.
So how on earth is Trump going to extricate himself from the Iran situation then? Is it limbo, ceasefire limbo forever? Or?
This is Matt Rogers from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
You know when people try a new food and suddenly it's like, wait.
That's the reaction a lot of people are having when they first try Kewpie mayo.
It's the one with the red cap and the little baby on the bottle. You've probably seen it in the grocery store before.
And if you've ever just walked past it, some people would say that's a huge mistake.
Because this mayo is different.
Most mayonnaise uses whole eggs. Kewpie only uses egg yolks, which gives it this rich umami flavor. It's smoother, deeper, and almost buttery.
Once people try it, they start putting it on everything.
Egg sandwiches, fries, burgers. Some fans even swear by dipping pizza crust in it.
And once you notice it, you start seeing it everywhere.
Chefs use it. Restaurants use it. People who really care about flavor use it.
Never tried it? Grab the bottle with the red cap next time you're at the store.
Put it on just about anything.
Then you'll understand.
Kewpie, the original Japanese mayonnaise.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Trump. The best thing Trump can do now is to let this blockade keep going till it peters out. You can, you know, the mega base that's left, he's lost 2/3 of his base. The people that actually voted for him to stop wars, take care of internal problems in the country, you know, things like that, you know, president should be doing, or king or prime minister, whomever you have in power, should be taking care of the country. Not the billionaire elites or, God forbid, Israel. The only real state in the United States. Well, most of those people have left. The mega crowd that's left are groupies. You can tell them whatever hell you want. They'll believe you. You're playing 59D chess. Well, in reality, you're playing 1D checkers. there's only forward and backwards is your only one dimension you can move. these people, I mean, these are the people that bought Trump coins. By the way, Trump made, between Trump and Milani coins, he made $30 billion off that.
Woo!
$30 billion off that.
What are they worth now? Zip?
Who cares? He's made the money. His partners have made the money.
You know, I mean, the people who bought those coins, did they just get ripped?
You know, and it's in there. It's not a financial instrument. And the way they were advertising, you can become part of the big family of Trump. You know, all one big family. I mean, Jesus, these people are groupies. They're middle-aged and boomer groupies, for the most part. That, I mean, these are the last people that can afford to go buy a Trump coin, but they've bought Trump coins. And yeah, $30 billion. You know, if this was anybody but the president of the United States, when he was about to become the president of the United States, they'd probably be getting investigated for a pump and dump. What it was, is a pump and dump. You know, there'd be federal charges pressed by this point. But no, this is okay. They're groupies. I'm sure the Senate, every Senate member is looking at it. Man, I could probably do my own coin. Why not? You know, if Trump could do it, let's do 100 different Trump Senate coins. But yeah, he could go that way. Unfortunately, I don't think he will, because even if he wants to and extricate himself from it, the Israelis aren't going to let are not releasing the pressure on his balls and on his spine. If nothing else, I mean, look, the Lebanon ceasefire, you know, where they're continuing to exterminate everybody that's still there. They are shelling Tyr, a 4,000-year-old city. They were just hitting Beirut again.
Is that what it's worth now? Wow, 20, that's gone down.
20 grand in a Trump coin as of the 20th of January 2025 is now worth $1,764. So they have lost, what is that, 90% of their 92%? Capital?
92%?
Holy crap! What a... I mean, that is your classic pump and dump right there. I mean, yeah. Jeez. And these people are groupies. I mean, they are absolute groupies that go into this. Oh my God! I mean, you think Biden was corrupt and Hillary's corrupt? They were. They're absolute. Man, Trump has taken the prize. Roman emperors couldn't come up with that level of corruption. I'm talking late Roman Empire. And I mean, this is, if we're still here in 100 years, historians are going to have a field day with this. For financial historians, Jesus.
Let's not forget his own stock. His stock in Donald J. Trump Media was $100 at one point.
Yeah,
and now it is trading at $9. So they've lost. People who bought at the peak have lost 90% of that as well.
Yep. And between him and Bessent, these are the people that have sunk the U.S. economy. Look, the U.S. economy is screwed. You know, he gets out tomorrow. The legacy of what's been done is done. And even if there's nothing to repair, and there's plenty to repair, even if there's nothing to repair, Europe is screwed because at the very minimum, there's going to be about a month and a half without oil, except what's coming out from Iran to its allies and friends, and a little bit that's coming out from Saudi Arabia, about 5 million barrels. And by the way, the U.S., it's a net importer of oil. Americans missed that point. The U.S. imports oil and oil products at the rate of 8.3 million barrels a day. It is still a net importer. No, it's not. And there's different reasons for that, particularly because most of the U.S. Refineries in the South are set up for heavy sour crude, which is Venezuela. Well, subsidizing Venezuelan oil with Russian oil, which is off the market for the U.S. now, too. And the problem with Venezuela, Maduro's fault and Chavez's fault before that, and partially the American fault, they took the money out of the oil industry for the various social projects, but you needed that money to replace and repair equipment. And then the U.S. froze their assets on top of that. Venezuela may have the biggest oil reserves, but it's low-grade oil. We'll just begin with that. There's actually a lake of tar in Venezuela where you can just go, you know, Which, by the way, well, you know, there used to be tar lakes all over the world. They just all got drained. By that was the first oil wells. You just drove up with a ladle and started filling your barrels until all that went away, and the dead dinosaurs inside became museum pieces. Because that's just a natural process. Well, after that, the problem is it's 800,000 barrels a day. That's it. That's all they can pump. If you push it to a million, you're probably going to break the equipment that's barely alive. This isn't a matter of fixing. This is a matter of replacing. The equipment is worn. That's it. And Exxon and Chevron gave an estimate of about $100 billion to get it up to 2 million barrels a day in 3 to 5 years. The crisis is here. That's the point. Yeah, this is in the future. I'm sure there'll be many more oil fields opening up. People will go invest because the money's, the pressure will be there. But that's in the future. The crisis is here. That's it. We're in the crisis already. It's just the last big wave is coming. That's the food crisis. That's coming in the summer. But everything else is here already. If you look at the spot rate, you know, when you're looking at the markets, they're telling you the future market rate. And that's all, you know, good feelings and butterflies and rainbows. If you look at the spot market, oil is well over $200.
Wow.
The reality of it. The spot markets, and that's where, by the way, Europe is buying off of, spot markets. So, and the UK too. I mean, by the way, you know what the UK, you know what the UK reserve for gas is? I think, if I remember correctly, something like 4 or 5 days.
Bloody hell. Stanislav.
That's why, by the way, every year, the British, rabid, Russophobic British press would shut the hell up in the winter for about 3 weeks while the British were buying at least 2 tankers of Russian LNG to make up for the lack of gas. And once those tankers arrived and unloaded, then they'd start back up. Now we can criticize Russia. Because, yeah, we're going to be warm for the rest of winter. And it happened every single friggin' year up to 22.
Stanislav, absolutely fascinating. Love all of the history. I've got so many more questions. Would love to get you back on. What would you like to say in conclusion to the viewers, please? And I would urge people to subscribe to your channel. Link is in the description box, and I'll put it in the live chat as well right now.
I'm also on X under Stanislav Krapivnik. We couldn't fit the whole name in. We Russians have long names. That's why we start getting smart. We have to figure out how to spell our own names. And by the way, a lot of times you're spelling your patronym, which is Stanislav Mikhailovich Krapivnik. Mikhailovich meaning son of Michael. And we have to you write the whole thing out. So yeah, you have to learn how to read pretty fast. Write your own name. The only thing I can say, look, we're here. Ladies and gentlemen, there is no time left. If the EU gets its way, you know, Russia right now has one of two choices: strike the EU manufacturers of drones with conventional weapons and go into a conventional war, or wait till Russia's blinded and do the nuclear strike. We're here. That's it. There's no more buffer zone. If you allow your politicians to do what they're doing, look at your children and ask, do you want to see them die as meat on the front? Or do you want to see them die as shadow puppets on a burnt out wall? Because that's the reality of it. That's it. We're out of time. Time has run out, and this is where we're at right now. So, you know, I don't know what else to say. It's well past midnight. I mean, it's well, maybe not well past midnight yet, but we're at midnight. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you're planning to do something, get your arse off your couch and go do something.
All right, on that bleak note, we salute your bravery for speaking out. I'm gonna finish the show and let you go. Thank you, my friend. Cheers.
Thank you. Cheers.
Cheers. Nice one. Absolutely fascinating. Thank you, viewers, you know, for all of the questions and everything that came in. So much on my mind hearing all the history there. To put it all together, going back, over 1,000 years of Russophobia. So, yeah, we'd love to get Stanislav back on. And the link for his X, link for his YouTube are in the description box if you're watching on replay. I'm putting him in the live chat again right now. And to let you guys know also what we've got coming up next. Tomorrow night, I've got Craig Lund back with Satanic Big Tech and part two. He was part of Silicon Valley, went through the rituals. And we had so many questions for him. We've brought him back to answer your questions, but he's also got a lot more to talk about as well. And then after that, that's 9 p.m. on Saturday. After that, we've got another Urien brother in California prison story. It's an exclusive, never been told before. And this is a guy called James, referred to us by Michael Thompson, did 35 years in the California prison. We just put it on premiere today, and the trailer is really hard-hitting. It's going to be a heavy-duty one. So that's 3.5 hours of content coming on Saturday night. Hope you're having a great weekend wherever in the world. Hope to see some of you in the next chat.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woo-hoo! Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.